Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Craig Spencer, Director of Global Health and Emergency Medicine at New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center, also on the board of Doctors Without Borders. Dr. Spencer worked on the front lines treating Ebola in West Africa, contracting and surviving that deadly disease. And he's also been sending dispatches from inside New York's emergency rooms and ICUs as the COVID-19 pandemic has raged on. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor of factcheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Craig Spencer here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Craig Spencer, Director of Global Health in Emergency Medicine at New York Presbyterian Columbia University's Medical Center. He's also Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine and Population and Family Health at Columbia University Medical Center. He's delivered care in a number of global settings, including West Africa during the Ebola outbreak, a disease he also contracted and recovered from during the epidemic.
Dr. Spencer's global health work is focused on securing human rights and access to medical care for those in the most vulnerable parts of our world. He's on the board of directors of Doctors Without Borders, and he's a contributing writer for the online publication Medium. Dr. Spencer, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, and you know, we're so moved by your writing and the work that you've done. Obviously, you've delivered healthcare all around the world in war zones that have been devastated by epidemics. And it's been a year since you started sharing your really human dispatches from inside New York's emergency rooms as the pandemic unfolded, which was, I think, fair to say, its own type of war zone. And here we are, we're a year out, COVID-19 death toll has just really been an unthinkable number. Close to 500,000 Americans are dead and millions around the globe. But there's also some good news, one hopes, which are the vaccines are being deployed and case numbers seem to be dropping. You say you're still seeing emergency rooms filled. We certainly see what's happening out on the West Coast in parts of the country. And you're also experiencing patients for which the vaccines can help as they're in the emergency rooms situation. I'm wondering if you can just share with our listeners what you're seeing now. How does it compare to those early days of the pandemic?
That's a great question. It's really nothing compares to the early days of the pandemic. You noted that I had worked in West Africa. I'd worked in the middle of civil conflict in Burundi. I've worked in some pretty tough places, and very few have actually taken my breath away, like walking into the emergency room in early April of 2020 and walking into what felt like the apocalypse. Yeah. I had more people die on a daily basis in New York City from COVID than I did in West Africa from Ebola at many points. And you know, the one thing that really stuck out to me this morning, I was listening to a report on NPR about a young emergency medicine doctor, a colleague out in LA, who had taken all these photos and tried to show the humanity of what was happening inside their emergency rooms there, facing similar situations to what we were facing almost a year ago. Mm-hmm. And it was heartening in a sense to know that my colleagues understand the difficulty of this, the challenge of this, and that in some sense, we're together in this crisis in unison and that we're sharing this experience. I think that's important for our mental health and for healing afterwards. But at the same time, I was really dejected because, as you said, it's been nearly a year that I started sharing, you know, the reality of COVID, what it means inside hospitals. And here I have colleagues of mine across the country that are really starting or, you know, really having to deal with this really hard on a daily basis, still in the same way that it was hitting us, you know, almost a year ago. So in that sense, the fact that it has been going on so long, that it was so acute, that it was so hard, it just made us all exhausted in a way that, quite frankly, I haven't been in a long time. Now, in New York City, we still have a high rate of COVID. If you look at the map, you know, we're still considered a severe outbreak, but it's very different than when it was in March and in April, when every single patient coming in was short of breath. had a low oxygen, many needed, you know, immediate resuscitation, many people died. We're still seeing COVID, but we're much better at managing it. And I think we're much better at managing ourselves as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Spencer, it feels like the whole world's been in a state of being overwhelmed by the COVID-19 pandemic for a whole year now. And we remember back before that when we were all concerned about Ebola, and now I understand Ebola has recently reemerged in Africa, eliciting tremendous concern in the global health community. And of course, you have the direct experience of having both cared for Ebola patients and having become very sick yourself with that. But you've said that your experience with Ebola did much to prepare you for our current experiences with COVID-19. I'd be really interested to hear, what lessons did you bring back from that experience of battling a deadly pathogen in a place where so little was known at the time and there were so few healthcare resources?
Yeah, that's a great question. There were, you know, practical things that I had learned, but also some more important, I think, coping strategies that I had learned from working in places like West Africa during Ebola. From a practical perspective, you know, in the US, we don't have to use personal protective equipment, or didn't really, all that often and all that well, right? We didn't have, and unless you were working primarily with TB patients, tuberculosis patients, or others with concerning infectious diseases, we didn't put on N95s all that often, the majority of us. We didn't have to really worry about the integrity of our personal protective equipment, because we weren't worried that every patient could potentially have a very deadly disease that could impact us and our families. And I think having had that experience in West Africa, putting on an N95 multiple times a day, you know, going through the donning and doffing process, recognizing that doffing is way more important than actual donning, that's where you're potentially infected. Knowing that having a PPE buddy, someone to check on you and really to make sure your personal protective equipment is put on correctly and remains protective throughout your shift. These are all really important things that I learned from others working in West Africa that I tried to implement here in New York City when we were dealing with COVID. But I think the more important lessons that I learned, and I think more important for myself and for my colleagues, was that doing this work isn't just physically exhausting, it's mentally exhausting. And at the beginning, I think there's a lot of motivation. This is challenging. I work in an emergency room where, you know, quite frankly, we love taking care of whatever comes through, is coming through the doors. And the bigger the challenge, the better. But after a couple of weeks of this, of seeing so many of your patients struggle to breathe, so many die, and really feeling helpless in a way, it was both morally dejecting and from a mental health perspective, I saw it starting to take a big toll. Mm-hmm. And I had gone through this before in West Africa. I'd learned some of those coping mechanisms. What do you do when not only your patients are getting sick, but some of your friends and your colleagues are as well? And so trying to create a space for my colleagues to be vulnerable, to share. You know, in medicine, we're not that great with sharing our vulnerabilities. We're not that great with talking about our mental health issues or our challenges. And so I thought really important early on was to make that space for my colleagues, my friends. Mm-hmm. And I think that helped and made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it certainly did. You know, I think there's no secret that the country, the United States, failed to meet the challenges of the pandemic, from denial to having no unified national testing protocols or any real public health strategies. And you said that we failed at every turn. I think we've heard people say a failure of the public health system seems to be too generous. It almost seemed to be criminal in nature, if you will, because the studies have shown that that if we could have reduced deaths by 40% in the United States, if we followed some simple basic public health protocols, which could have been articulated at a national level, this 50 state strategy never seemed to work and still probably isn't the smartest move. Talk to us about the public health failures that led to the catastrophe and what we must learn from these really unfortunate, harsh lessons that devastated the lives of so many Americans.
Yeah, I want to say in retrospect, it gets me quite frustrated, but it's not retrospect, right? We're still in the throes of this pandemic, but we can look back on the previous administration and I think reflect on a lot of the early missteps that set us up for failure that we continue to see, right? We're having, you know, the equivalent of, you know, a 9/11 in terms of deaths every single day in this country. Even as case numbers and hospitalizations numbers goes down, deaths are still stubbornly high. Look, I wrote in 2015 in the New England Journal of Medicine a reflection on my experience with Ebola and how politics had played into the public health response then. And if you recall, there were many governors, including one who was leading the response here in my own home state, who politicized the way that we responded and the public health measures needed to, you know, to respond to Ebola at that time. And what I said was that, you know, in times of national crisis and national, you know, disease outbreaks and public health emergencies, we need really one unified and codified plan from the CDC, not 50 different ideas that can change with their proximity to the next election. And we've seen that throughout, right? And a lot of this was stoked by an administration that did undermine public health guidance early on, that undermined the value of things like masking and the importance of testing, that made it much more difficult to access some of these critical supplies that were necessary to not only understand the scale and the speed of this pandemic, but to help get it under control. And I think that's reflected in the fact that the US has 4% of the population and over 20% of the cases and the deaths. We did not need to fail this poorly. We did not need to fail this long, to the point we're now at, you know, half a million deaths from COVID and counting. I think it would have been bad here, regardless of who is in charge. This virus itself is mean. We are unfortunately a perfect population for this virus by virtue of being imperfect. We have a lot of chronic diseases. There's an older population. You know, a lot of the things that increase the susceptibility to severe outcomes from COVID. That being said, if we had put in place a strong public health system, not only at the outset of this pandemic, but beforehand, when we knew that a pandemic was coming, and still we underfunded our public health, and pandemic preparedness for so long, we could have prevented a lot of the cases, a lot of the hospitalizations, and a lot of the deaths.
Well, Dr. Spencer, I want to talk about death for a moment. And I know the days when people lined up in the streets in New York and banged their pots and pans in appreciation have faded away. I do think there is a profound and deep ongoing new appreciation for what healthcare workers do when they run towards trouble and not away from it. But the reality was, as you referenced in your opening remarks, healthcare workers were experiencing death at a volume and a rapid and a daily basis that most of us in healthcare have never experienced in our lives. And we've heard from so many people that there seemed to be almost a universal commitment in hospitals to making sure that if people had to die without their loved ones there, they weren't going to die alone. And healthcare workers, all of them, whatever the titles after their name, really did their best to try and bring that end-of-life experience to make it as humane as they could. I know you produced a really powerful video of that experience. Maybe share with our listeners what you all were doing on the inside to try and bring that compassion and presence to people at the end of life.
Yeah, the one thing that I say about what I do, emergency medicine, is that our job is to save lives. Really, that's what we do, whether it's trauma or a heart attack or a stroke or whatever it may be. Our job in the emergency department is to save lives and to stabilize. And so many times we found ourselves standing beside a ventilator after speaking with a family, after talking about goals of care, and turning the ventilator off and trying to give some humanity in those last moments of life as those breaths slipped away from someone's father or grandfather or loved one. And it was unlike anything the majority of us had ever done. Even in West Africa, you know, the death from Ebola was horrible and was painful and was difficult to see, but there was something so unnerving and so unexpected about it here in the US. You know, working in one of the largest hospital systems, having access to anything you could imagine, right, a 24-hour MRI and CAT scan, right, you know, unlimited resources, for some reason just made this that much harder to bear. You know, calling up families on the phone, talking to them and trying to explain these end-of-life discussions, likely outcomes over a grainy FaceTime video, was not only really difficult, just technically, it didn't always work so great, and it was really hard to get through, but it just was never an easy discussion. It never got easier, it never got better. It was always difficult because on the other end of that video connection was a family or a loved one who was hearing for the first time that their family, their father, their best friend, the person they love the most in this world is likely going to die. And we may have got better at managing the words that we used or thinking about the script or, you know, the training that we actually got as people who are really adept and committed to saving lives. We had to learn about how we talk about what happens at the end of life a lot better. And that was, a challenge for all of us, but especially for us in the emergency department.
But really those small acts of kindness were so important and made such a profound difference as someone transitioned on and their family was grieving and you were there. So thank you. You know, we're speaking with Dr. Craig Spencer, Director of Global Health in Emergency Medicine at New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Assistant Center. He's Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine and Population and Family Health at Columbia University Medical Center. He's also on the board of Medicine's Sans Frontier, Doctors Without Borders. You know, there's some good news on the horizon, the vaccines here. Supplies are starting to increase, and we've got a new administration, the Biden administration. And there's a lot to think about, but I really wonder, with this new administration focused in on trying to improve the delivery system, trying to increase supplies, what's your hope for this new administration? What maybe guidance that you'd like to provide them as they think about the path from here to the next stage and hopefully getting through the rollout of vaccines?
It's a great question. I'll reflect first on how things have gone so far and what I think needs to be a bigger part of the discussion going forward. You know, Ron Klain, who's the White House chief of staff, was the Ebola czar back when I was treating patients in West Africa. And, you know, April of 2020, well, before he had any elected position or any position in the White House, I remember him tweeting out that, you know, getting a vaccine is going to be hard, but getting a vaccine into vials and getting a vaccine out would arguably be even more difficult. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is something that has been on the mind of the people who are now in the Oval Office, who are now overseeing the rollout of this vaccine. And that in itself is heartening. We've seen the numbers over the past few weeks go up. You know, we've doubled the number of vaccines that are being administered now compared to just 4 weeks ago when this administration took over. I think some of that was gonna happen regardless. This rocky start and rollout was gonna get better regardless of who was in office. But I think that there has been a really coordinated push from the federal government to try to coordinate this much better at the local and state level. And I think that's what we've needed all along, not just with vaccines, but with testing and PPE and treatments, et cetera. I'm quite heartened because really to go from sequencing a genome just over a year ago to having vaccines with over 90% efficacy and getting them into the arms of millions of people is absolutely stunning. And I think a testament to the miracle of science. I suspect that, you know, as promised, we will likely have the majority of those eligible in the country vaccinated by this summer. We will have some sense of return of normalcy in the months after that, especially if these vaccines do prove to be as efficacious as the studies have borne out. And that's all great news. The one thing that really concerns me is more around the issues of vaccine equity and what we're going to be doing here in the U.S. to prepare the rest of the world, because it may be cliche, but we're not safe until we're all safe. And that's a big part of the discussion that I haven't seen enough of yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are happy to tell you that here in Connecticut, those vaccines are getting into the arms, and we're out there on the front lines every day doing drive-through clinics, on-site clinics, going to homeless shelters, the whole strategy that we need to reach people. But we know when you say we're not safe till all of us are safe, we're thinking globally, and certainly from your work with Doctors Without Borders and your commitment to global health, we are very concerned about what happens outside of the United States. We've been following the World Health Organization's COVAX efforts and wonder if you can comment on how well you think that is going beyond what we can do here in the United States. How are we doing with this as a global strategy, and how satisfied are you with the efforts to date, and what do you think needs to be done next?
What I've been saying is that I personally have received more doses of a COVID vaccine than 130 countries. I'm very lucky, and I'm quite happy that I'm protected, but there are healthcare workers all around the world, like myself and other vulnerable groups, that may not be vaccinated until 2022 or 2023, that may be years away. And the COVAX facility, I think, is great. It is an attempt to try to secure those doses primarily for countries that don't have the ample contracts and purchasing power of advanced economies like our own. It's, I think, a necessary step to make sure that we get the world vaccinated. That's the best way to prevent variants that can evade the immune response or the protective effect of the vaccines. That's the best way to prevent them from developing. In terms of, you know, is COVAX going to be the one and only solution? No, COVAX has said that their goal is really to try to get 20% of the eligible population vaccinated by the end of this year. We need more than that. COVAX also, unfortunately, has a huge funding shortfall of, you know, over $27 billion. And it may sound like a lot, but it pales in comparison to the amount that advanced economies like the U.S. would lose if we continue with this inequitable vaccine rollout across the world. What I mean by that, there's been studies by International Chamber of Commerce, Rand Institute, et cetera, that have estimated up to, you know, $4, 5, maybe even $9 trillion in economic losses. And half of that being borne by advanced economies like the US, even if we get our whole population vaccinated, because of the drag on the global economy, continuing COVID around the world would represent. So I think there's a strong moral humanitarian argument for making sure we do more to get more vaccine into more arms outside of this country. There is a strong public health argument because, you know, getting more people vaccinated around the world prevents the development of these variants, which can undermine our protective vaccine strategy, the protective effective vaccines. And there's also a really strong economic argument. And I think that needs to be brought back to the U.S., to other wealthy countries who to date have contracts for more vaccines than they have even for people who are eligible to receive a vaccine. And think about how we don't not only concentrate on our equitable distribution here in the U.S., which has been problematic, but how we concentrate on that as well globally.
Well, it's so important. We are all passengers on Spaceship Earth. And so we need to keep on understanding we're all in this together. And, you know, you've lamented that the world did not appear to learn from the lessons of Ebola or MERS or SARS. And that really fundamentally needs to change. And you just launched a new series of pieces on the online publication Medium, really to use your frontline experience battling epidemics and pandemics to help foster a deeper understanding of these challenges. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the series you're embarking on.
Absolutely. You know, about a year ago, I think I had 500 followers on Twitter. I mostly tweeted out about human rights in Niger, where I was doing some work, and the impact on human health. And once COVID hit, I used Twitter as a place to try to share kind of these public health pearls, the reality of what was happening on the front line. And in that process over the past year, have gained over 200,000 followers and really have had, I think, a megaphone to try to share the reality of what's happening with COVID in this country. But Twitter isn't perfect for sharing a lot of nuance. Yeah. And so the goal was through this writing series, this contributor series with Medium, so every week to share something that's more than just a hot take on the latest news, mm-hmm. but to really look deeply into what got us here, how we're managing this, and what needs to happen going forward. And in the first piece, I looked at my experience from Ebola and what that taught me in terms of preparing for COVID. This idea that preparedness is not only the best financial investment from a public health perspective, it's absolutely key. And we need to prioritize this so that we're not continuing to talk about how we should have learned the lessons next time. But also, I want to look into some of these deeper issues on, you know, what primed the healthcare system here in the US to fail so miserably, right? There are many kind of pre-existing conditions that we have, mm-hmm. lack of access to, you know, to quality, affordable healthcare mm-hmm. for millions of Americans mm-hmm. in the country with, you know, spending the most by far per capita on healthcare. How do we address these inequities, and how do these inequities really line us up to have such a profound impact from this virus here in the country, all over this country? So really the goal of this Medium relationship, this collaboration for the next 6 months, is to weekly reflect on one of these issues, to think about how we prepare better, how we should have known better, and what we actually do with that moving forward. And this week I'm writing on this idea of vaccine nationalism, you know, the hoarding of vaccine in advanced countries. And going forward, I'll talk about, you know, the reasons for and against things like vaccine passports and what that would mean for people in other countries, issues around access to treatments, how we actually fund and prepare for pandemics in places as the climate changes and makes us all more vulnerable. So it's a lot of work. It's a lot of reflection. It's meant to be a lot of fun. And hopefully I'll be able to share a lot that I've been trying to on Twitter threads, but with a lot more nuance and a lot more detail.
Oh, such an important voice.
Great. Thanks. We've been speaking today with Dr. Craig Spencer. He's the Director of Global Health and Emergency Medicine at New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center. He's also the Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine and Population and Family Health at Columbia University Medical Center. Learn more about his work and access his writing on the pandemic by going to craigaspencer@medium.com or follow him on Twitter at craigaspencer. Dr. Spencer, we want to thank you for your revealing look at the front lines of pandemic treatment and care, for your commitment to advancing global health, your straightforward comments, and for joining us today on Conversation on Healthcare.
Thank you so much, Margaret and Mark. It was a pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
We've seen plenty of misinformation about COVID-19 circulating on social media. One example, headlines on videos and unreliable websites have distorted the facts about a recent order by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that mandates face masks be worn on public transportation. The order doesn't require that individuals wear two masks, as the social media posts claim. CDC guidance issued with the order does say that cloth masks should be made of at least two layers, as the agency has long recommended. Some independent experts are now advising that wearing two masks, such as a cloth mask paired with a surgical mask, in some situations could provide greater benefit when it comes to controlling the spread of the novel coronavirus. And the CDC has posted the results of a lab experiment that found a cloth mask worn over a medical procedure mask can significantly improve the fit and effectiveness of the masks. The CDC's website suggests that form of double masking as one modification for better protection. But the federal agency has not issued a demand that the public wear two masks, as the social media posts claim. The CDC order, which went into effect February 1st, only says that those using public transportation must wear a mask, which the order defines as, quote, a material covering the nose and mouth of the wearer, excluding face shields. It's worth noting that while the text of the CDC order says it reserves the right to enforce the order through criminal penalties, it said it doesn't intend to rely on such penalties and instead anticipates voluntary compliance. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Sub-Saharan Africa leads the world in maternal and infant deaths each year. According to an annual report from Save the Children, an estimated 397,000 babies died at birth in that region in 2013, and some 550 mothers died per day as well. Most of the causes have to do with lack of access to medical care in these low-resource regions, and often the local midwives lack formal medical training to prepare them to conduct interventions in the event of a life-threatening event like a hemorrhage or an infection.
We know that 90% of all the deaths that we see today could be prevented if the mother had access to this, you know, really basic skilled care during the childbirth.
Anna Frelin is CEO of the Maternity Foundation, a Copenhagen-based nonprofit dedicated to eliminating maternal and infant death in the world. Their organization has created an intervention for midwives living in low-resource areas if they just have access to a smartphone. It's called the Safe Delivery App, and it provides comprehensive training for midwives that teach them and guide them on what to do in the event of a birthing crisis.
This is really a matter of building the skills of the health workers who are already out there and empower them to be able to better handle the emergencies that, you know, may occur during a childbirth, such as, you know, the woman starts bleeding or the newborn is not breathing and so forth. So first and foremost, it's a matter of finding a way that we can reach the health workers and build their skills.
Frelin says the real promise of the Safe Delivery application lies in its ability to provide ongoing obstetric and neonatal training so that local midwives can gain important clinical knowledge over time. The Safe Delivery app has been designed to be culturally relevant and easily understood, and it's received the United Nations approval for wider deployment. The Maternity Foundation plans to have the Safe Delivery app in the hands of 10,000 healthcare workers across the region by next year, potentially impacting a million live births. A low-cost, culturally sensitive mobile app that offers immediate guidance and assistance to midwives and health workers, the backbone of the healthcare system in low-resource areas, empowering them with ongoing support and knowledge that can improve birth outcomes. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.